Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. When Russia launched its full-scale war on Ukraine in late February 2022, it led many countries to search for alternative trade routes to those passing through Russian territory, and also to seek suppliers of energy resources to replace oil and natural gas previously purchased from Russia. The search brought a sudden new importance to Central Asia. The five countries of Central Asia have probably never enjoyed so much international attention as they have in the last 2 years. One sign of this is a series of summits the five Central Asian leaders, as a group, have attended. This new importance naturally has had an effect on the way they govern their individual countries. So how much has Central Asia's global status changed, and how much has it affected regional ties and domestic policies in the five countries? To discuss all this, I am joined by Catherine Putz, managing editor at the Diplomat magazine and author of many articles about Central Asia, Nargiz Kasenova, a senior fellow and director of the program on Central Asia at Harvard Davis Center for Russia and Eurasian Studies, and Luke Ancheski, professor of Central Asian Studies at Glasgow University and author of several books on Central Asia, the latest being Analyzing Kazakhstan's Foreign Policy Regime, Neo-Eurasianism in the Nazarbayev Era. Thank you all for joining me. And Katie, I'd like to start with you. Can you give us an idea of where the Central Asian leaders have been going?
Where have they not been going is probably a better question. I think when we think about the engagements that the Central Asian leaders have done this year, the first that comes to my mind is the summit with China in May in Xi'an. And then there was the C5 plus one leaders meeting in September in New York in the United States. And then there was the Berlin summit. Those are sort of the three big ones, but throughout the year, there have been just dozens of high level visits from many countries. You know, you have Turkey, you have Italy, you have France. And so I think this really, you know, if we took the time to sit down and write out this list, I think this would probably be the year that has had the most diplomatic engagement. I haven't made that list, so I could be wrong, but it's certainly up there.
Okay, thank you. Now, Giz, is it fair to say that the Central Asians have never seen this much attention to their countries?
I would second that. Definitely, there has been a lot of summitry this year and last year as well, and it is driven by what you outlined at the beginning, Bruce. All these growing divisions, geopolitical shifts, geoeconomic shifts, search for more reliable supply chains, energy sources, and so on and so forth. Also, support in the various international bodies, UN General Assembly, etc. But I also want to emphasize that the region seems to be more ready for it. We have been seeing centripetal and centrifugal trends inside the region over the past three decades, and now I think we see a pretty good and promising centrifugal trend again when the countries of the region try to stick together more. And I think we see a certain consolidation of regional identity, and that's something that I think we all like.
Okay, thank you. Luca, what are the Central Asian leaders getting out of this? I mean, we've mentioned energy resources and trade corridors, and certainly that's a big thing, part of this. But what are they getting when they go to all these meetings? Because certainly it seems like they have their hands out in every direction these days.
Well, I think that in parallel to this, increasing attention that they attracted internationally, there are some domestic developments that are of significance. And to me, the most important one of these is certainly the fact that the region is becoming more authoritarian. Mm-hmm. We've had a post-pandemic process of authoritarian entrenchment, which through some, sort of revolutions, like in Kyrgyzstan, or attempted or sort of completed dynastic transition in Tajikistan and in Turkmenistan, or constitutional amends like in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, we do really have the current leadership enjoying as much power as probably ever had, which means that in a system like Central Asia, where foreign policy is not only mostly controlled by the president and their administration, but also foreign policy is a function of domestic power interest, I think this increased attention, this increased involvement an international level, has resulted in a sort of further strengthening of the power. And this is something which, you know, we've seen by all of these different deals that they made, those with China, those with Turkey, but even in the kind of more ambiguous relationship with both the European Union or with Russia on the other hand. So it seemed to me that you had this consolidation at domestic power, which is carried out internationally against the backdrop of this increased symmetry that's happened in the last couple of years, Bruce.
Yeah, thanks. Great. You know, I noticed that too, that it seemed like they were becoming more authoritarian. But Nargis, let me get to you with this question. Is this kind of strange? Because at the same time, Western governments are showing obviously much more attention towards Central Asia than before and engagement, including, as Katie mentioned, you know, there was a C5+1 summit in New York on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. It's the first time an American president has ever met with all five Central Asian leaders at one time. And yet it comes at you know, in a period when the Central Asian leaders are actually moving further from democracy and the kind of values that the U.S. and these individual countries used to discuss regularly.
Well, let me start by partially contesting that. I think the only country in Central Asia that has been moving away from democracy is Kyrgyzstan. The region, you know, has had consolidated authoritarian regimes for all these years. So it is worrying what's happening in Kyrgyzstan. Let's see how sustainable this new trend is, or whether, you know, it's another kind of oscillation in Kyrgyzstan's political development. Otherwise, well, these used to be authoritarian regimes. They are authoritarian regimes, but I think we see some interesting dynamic in Kazakhstan with the political reforms, with the introduction of direct elections at lower levels. I see these as attempts at introducing more accountability in the system without threatening the system. Definitely, we haven't seen, you know, free and fair parliamentary elections or presidential elections, but I think the politics kind of at the lower level is getting more interesting. As for the Western engagement, well, democracy promotion, human rights promotion is not the only interest, the only driver of the engagement, and I would see other drivers, other factors coming to the forefront much more forcefully. We see the international order as we knew it now kind of breaking apart under a lot of pressure, and it is important for Western countries to kind of to maintain that order. And Central Asian states are on board with that. They are interested in the maintenance of the international law, of the principles, sovereignty, territorial integrity, and all that. And we hear this over and over in joint statements made by Central Asians and Western policymakers. There are security matters at stake. Energy security is very important for all parties involved. And in addition to that, I think there's certain crisis in confidence. The state of democracy in the West is, you know, kind of debated and maybe not as good as we would have hoped. Well, there was January crisis in the United States, the country I'm in now. We see kind of interesting elections in European countries. So I think it's a combination of factors.
Thank you. You know, Katie, Nargis was talking about security, and I like, Nargis, that you shifted right away to energy security. But, you know, actual security, considering Central Asia is located north of Afghanistan, that used to be the top of the agenda. And any conversation that any Central Asian leader had with another foreign leader, what are the big topics now? Where did security drop to? And what are they talking about when they go and meet these leaders? What are the big topics now?
I think the sort of big topics, it depends on the country. So when the United States, for example, meets with Central Asia, Ukraine is a big topic. It's not always billed highly, but as Nargis mentioned, the sort of the concepts of territorial integrity and sovereignty. Those things are very heavily emphasized, and I think we can read those as references to Russia and the war in Ukraine. Energy security was already mentioned, and that is a massive one, not necessarily for the United States, but for Europe. And the United States has certainly vested interests in Europe's security, including its energy security. And then, you know, I think one of the more interesting sort of things to come out of, for example, the C5+1 was the idea of working with Central Asia on rare earth elements and sort of the really the building blocks of future energy and renewable energy into the future and sort of the role that Central Asia may play in that. And I think that that feeds into larger U.S. interests, but it certainly is in the interest of the Central Asian countries to make themselves, you know, a source for these materials that are going to possibly gain them much wealth, but also keep them sort of relevant. It is interesting that, you know, we're however long into this podcast, and we're only now mentioning Afghanistan, which used to be the number one issue when you talked about Central Asia. I think certainly for the Central Asian countries that border Afghanistan, Afghanistan still shows up in all of their statements, you know, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan. And when you look at when the Central Asian leaders meet, for example, with Putin, Afghanistan is mentioned in those meetings also. So I think that that's still very much in the mind of regional leaders, but it is not the acute crisis that either it was or that everybody believed that it was. But those are some of the things that we see in these statements.
Great, thank you. Luca, to stick with energy security for just a second, you know, this, everyone knew that the Central Asians had all these resources for a long time. Now they're getting, like we've been saying, there's a lot more attention being paid to that during these summits. Who's actually making progress on getting energy resources, new energy resources out to some of these countries?
I mean, Bruce, I think that you got this big gap between what they say they want to do and what they're actually able to do. I mean, unfortunately, the two big exporters, which are Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, they have not significantly changed the direction of the energy trade. I mean, we found out this year that there's still over than 80% of Kazakhstani gas or Kazakhstani energy traded gets to Russia, whereas Turkmenistan or gas pretty much exclusively goes to China. So there is a lot of talks, but not much change. But talks is important nonetheless. It's important because it really sort of, to me, gels with this idea that there is a polarizing Eurasia at the backdrop. You know, like the invasion of Ukraine made Eurasia, you either with Russia or you against Russia, especially, you know, when you see that scenario from, you know, from Europe where I am. So in that scenario, you do really have the opening of new opportunities to change the direction of your energy trade. I haven't really followed that much what Kazakhstan is doing in that way. But of course, I've been doing much more work on the changes or the prospective changes of Turkmenistan gas. There are a few interesting options that seem to be opening. The reality, though, is that these energy systems, which are very large and very rich, are actually still managed with an authoritarian outlook in mind, which means that before the profit, within the change, you had to look after the elite that regulates and manages these resources, which makes all kind of deals difficult to reach in the short term. And also in terms of infrastructure, of course, there is hope. You know, there is the promise of a future comes with infrastructure, but this kind of infrastructure are extremely difficult to build. And we saw that in the case of Turkmenistan with both TAPI, which has to go to Afghanistan, and also in the continuous talks that are about building pipelines, they go across the Caspian Sea. So I think that maybe the moment is coming, but we're not there yet. But I think that there could be momentum for something major happen in the next couple of years.
You know, let me follow up on that. Since you mentioned Turkmenistan, you know, we know that Turkmenistan has been, they have their policy of positive neutrality, which a lot of people have equated with being simply isolationist. Has the change in geopolitics since Russia invaded Ukraine actually pulled Turkmenistan somewhat out of its isolation? I mean, you know, you mentioned that they talk about some of these deals and they have talked about it, but they're talking about sending gas to Europe a lot more than they used to, and talking about shipping gas to people that you didn't consider, Iraq, for instance, in the past, much more than they used to. Is Turkmenistan kind of emerging as a side effect from Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
Well, I think that the scenario has changed for them as well. They realize that the China trade is no longer sustainable in the long run, not because it's insubstantial, but because it's unlikely to grow. Because China sets a limit to how much gas they buy from a given producer, which means that now we have to seriously look at different options. And the two main options are those that go across the Caspian, which, you know, to me is very complicated because you open a Pandora box when you start talking about gas routes that bypass Russia or, you know, they don't have Russia's blessing. To me, the key to Turkmenistan international relations in general is how the regime interprets the border with Iran. Should that border become somewhat more porous, somewhat more conducive to trade, especially energy trade, where you really do need a change. I mean, there is a new president in Turkmenistan. There is a somewhat different elite. Well, you know, same elite, but with some changes. And it seemed to me that if they want to keep growing, especially in the authoritarian sense, you know, using resources as a way to kleptocratically control the country, that's the kind of border they had to open. So, but again, we're not there yet. And considering the size of the trade that happens, that may happen across the Caspian, which is kind of minor, that could be the prospect, you know, which is trade with Iran or through Iran, that may change Turkmenistan foreign policy, because this is a country that exports just one product. So which means that the whole economic foreign policy is predicated about this gas trade. So let's just watch this space and see what happens in the next couple of years.
Can I jump in, Bruce? Please,
go ahead.
Yeah, I think there is a small silver lining, or maybe not so small actually, with Turkmenistan over the past couple of years. I think they have been a little bit opening up to the dialogue and cooperation on climate change related issues. And I recently at the COP, they made that pledge on methane methane emissions reduction, which is huge given, you know, how much Turkmenistan is emitting. So maybe, you know, something good will come out of it, of that perceived need to cooperate more, to reduce dependencies. But I fully agree with Luca. They are locked in these relations. The infrastructure is there. The pipeline from Turkmenistan is to China, so they are fully dependent on Chinese market, the same way as Kazakhstan is dependent on Russia for the transit of its oil. 90% of Kazakh oil is exported via Russia, and you can't change it overnight or even over a couple of years. And in the other energy sector, in the sector of renewables, there are more opportunities, more flexibility. And we see how external powers are trying to develop cooperation. Central Asian states are also very active now in trying to develop these different cooperation frameworks. And as Katie mentioned, there are all these partnerships blossoming on the development of the rare earths, critical materials. We see similar dynamic with the renewables. I would add the Gulf states into our discussion. I think it was very important that there was a Gulf Cooperation Council summit with Central Asian states this year. And renewables are a big part of it, water security, food security. So we see this kind of diversification of links, relations, investments, and so on.
Thanks. And actually, let me follow up on that with you real quick. You know, some of the contracts that Kazakhstan has signed with Western companies in recent months, and I mean during the trip to the C5 plus one in New York, and then the meeting in Germany, were focused on rare earths and also uranium development, both with U.S. companies and with German companies. How important are these resources for the Western countries? And does this make Kazakhstan something of a new El Dorado for rare earths?
With the ongoing energy transition, rare earths, and I think probably it's better to use the term critical materials as more inclusive. And well, obviously, these are very important. And now China has a full dominance in this area, and US, European Union, they are trying to decrease this dependence. And that's why they're looking for other supplies, for alternative supplies. And Central Asian states can become, you know, one of the sources, this kind of an alternative source of these critical materials. But rare earths and critical materials are not that rare. They exist in different parts of the world. So it is important now to use this window of opportunity and to actually move ahead, sign contracts, start developing these mineral fields. So the window of opportunity is there, and it's good there is interest, and Kazakhstani government definitely wants to grab this opportunity.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And a reminder, we're talking about Central Asia's new global importance since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And my guests are Nargiz Khasanova, Senior Fellow and Director of the Program on Central Asia at Harvard Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies, Luke Ancheski, Professor of Central Asian Studies at Glasgow University and author of several books on Central Asia, the latest of those books being Analyzing Kazakhstan's Foreign Policy Regime, Neo-Eurasianism in the Nazarbayev Era, and Catherine Putz, Managing Editor at The Diplomat Magazine and author of many articles about Central Asia. Katie, I want to get to you on this because I want to talk a little bit about renewables, not so much what they can export from Central Asia, but about attempts to bring renewable energy to Central Asia. It's been a key topic. And I think everyone, strangely, in all the C5 meeting summits that they've had, except the one with Russia, where they plugged Rosatom, made its pitches for nuclear power plants in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. But otherwise, that was it. But everywhere else that these five guys go, this has been one of the topics at the top of the agenda is renewables. How important is that for Central Asia?
I mean, I think it is certainly there are a couple ways it's important. There's sort of the rhetorical value. You know, it is important to these countries to be seen as on the forefront of renewable energy, even if I think, as Luke pointed out, this is a lot of talk. It's not necessarily quite there yet. You know, Kazakhstan's economy is still based on oil and gas. Turkmenistan's is still based on oil and gas. And so, you know, at the same time, there have been a number of projects announced. I'll take Kazakhstan as an example. You know, at COP28, there was a lot of discussion about several wind farm projects that Kazakhstan has agreed. One is with the United Arab Emirates. There's another one with France, with a French company. And these have the potential to sort of add to the share of renewables in Kazakhstan's sort of energy mix. But it's nowhere near sort of where, you know, I think some people would say these things need to be. But, you know, I think these provide avenues for development that is not necessarily threatening to the existing sort of power structures around energy in the region. You mentioned that, you know, Russia doesn't really talk about the renewables with the Central Asian countries because Russia's energy relations with the region are fossil fuel based, and they will continue to be. And that is still a huge part of these countries' economies. That said, you know, these developments offer a country like Kazakhstan an opportunity to make ties and sort of make deals with additional partners. And we haven't said it yet, but multi-vector diplomacy still plays a huge role, I think, in Kazakhstan's outlook on the world. And we see that with these kinds of deals. I want to mention also sort of the uranium issue. You know, Kazakhstan is one of the world's largest producers of uranium, and that has been true for a long time. And so as other countries look to nuclear as an option in the renewable energy mix, one that I think has its share of controversies around it, but is certainly France, for example, uses a lot of nuclear power. Kazakhstan has sort of further opportunities to make deals in that sector as well.
Okay, thank you. Boy, we've still got a lot to talk about, not much time. So let's move on to Middle Corridor real quick. And Nargiz, I know you just hosted a conference on Middle Corridor. How much progress have the Central Asians made toward opening this so-called Middle Corridor? I mean, obviously, what the European Union countries would like to see is that it could totally replace the Russian transportation routes, which it doesn't seem even close to being able to replace yet. But have they made much progress in the last 20 months, 22 months?
Well, there have been a good amount of progress, but I don't think it can fully substitute the northern route. But definitely now there is an opportunity because, well, going through Russia now is problematic, and we did see the reduction in container freight across Russia for obvious reasons. So there is an opportunity, but I think the potential of the Middle Corridor is, well, limited. The World Bank report gives pretty optimistic assessment of what the Middle Corridor can do, but even with that, I don't think it can substitute, the northern route. Among Central Asian states, Kazakhstan is the main pusher, the main agent, and it's understandable why Astana is pushing it, because Kazakhstan is the main beneficiary of the routes and already has the infrastructure built in Kazakhstan. It needs to improve the infrastructure on the Caspian Shore. It needs to together with other participant states, streamline the logistics. Well, enhance infrastructure, address upcoming challenges like the shallowing of the Caspian Sea. But I do see progress. Azerbaijan is on board, Georgia is on board, Turkey is very much on board, the EU now is on board. We need investments. What I thought was interesting when we discussed the report with the World Bank manager was that the money is not a problem. There is plenty of finance that can help foster the Middle Corridor. It's more pulling, for the countries need to pull themselves together and improve the soft infrastructure of the Middle Corridor. And so the challenge is there. Let's see if we'll see much progress next year. Yeah, let me stop here.
Okay, thank you. Luca, we've been watching Central Asia for decades now, and the leadership of all these countries have pretty much been advertising exactly that. We're the crossroads of Eurasia, making these allusions to the old Silk Route, all that kind of stuff. Can we at least say that this is something of a watershed moment where after all these years, the world is finally starting to pay much more attention to the potential of Central Asia as a trade corridor? And has this helped Central Asia and probably will it continue to help Central Asia in its goal for connectivity?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that it is, there is an unprecedented level of international attention that is thrust upon the region. But 3 decades onwards, since independence, I think that it's time to transform this attention into actual results. So, we saw that the imposition of connectivity model from China, actually, has not led to dramatic change. Well, it has led to the establishment of directional trade going towards China, but it's not really diversified that much. In fact, it created, as Nargis was saying before, this dependency of Kazakhstan and not Turkmenistan onto China. I would like to see the development of truly multi-directional trade from the region, in the next 5 to 10 years. And, this attention coming from all over, from different sides, the Middle East, China, Europe, can only be a benefit if they are able to transform, and transform their potential into actual outcomes. And we've seen that in the case of China, this hasn't really happened all the time. So there is a step change required, and the step change can be required is that the authoritarian outlook of these states become more globalized. I mean, Uzbekistan has opened the way in that sense. This new modernized authoritarianism that we saw in Uzbekistan in 2016 has globalized fairly successfully. Kazakhstan has been there for a while, but we now need to have this step change in the establishment of truly multidirectional relationship, not only out with the region, but also within the region. So I think the first step to have a more sort of globalized Central Asia is really the creation of working, effective, flexible trade relationship within the region. That's something which, you know, it may be happening in the next 5 to 10 years as well.
Can I add to that? Can I draw on that?
Okay, please, go ahead.
Well, absolutely. I agree with Luca. I think intra-regional cooperation is happening. We see improvements in this regard, and that's something that I started with. I think we do see a certain consolidation of regional identity, Central Asian identity. But here I also want to add the growing connectivity with the South Caucasus, with the region of South Caucasus. And that was one of the findings of the World Bank report, that they envision an increase in trade between the two regions. And that's actually where most of the increase will take place rather than, you know, along this Europe, Central Asia corridor. And that's where the most promise is. And obviously this connectivity between the two regions can really work nicely if there is more cooperation connectivity inside the region of Central Asia. And it seems to me that now we are more ready for it than in the early 90s, for example, when there was a push in this direction, when there was an attempt to create a Central Asian Union. I think now we are more ready. And the nation state building processes have been, we can argue about that, but definitely Central Asian states are, you know, more like nation states now than they used to be in the early 1990s. And they have state institutions, they have some national identity, and they are more secure in this regard. So they can actually afford themselves to cooperate more and to create certain interdependencies through this process of Central Asian cooperation, maybe, you know, embryonic integration.
Okay, thank you. Katie, I got to give you a chance to comment on this too. Middle corridor, but, you know, do you think, again, as I mentioned, the Central Asians have been billing themselves as a big trade hub for the Eurasian continent. Have we at least seen something of a start or a new push toward realizing that dream one day in the last, you know, a few months since Russia invaded Ukraine?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to the middle corridor, you know, it's an idea that is 20-something years old. I think Turkey proposed it in the early 2000s. But it is very possible that it is an idea for whose time has come. You know, there is certainly more interest in realizing it on the European end than there has really ever been. And I think that's reciprocated in Central Asia. As Nargis pointed out, and Luca also pointed out, you know, there might be limited the ability of the middle corridor to sort of take the northern routes out is sort of a pipe dream, right? But it can sort of add another sort of route that is useful for Central Asian countries. But I think one of the things, and Nargis mentioned this, you know, there's the hard sort of infrastructure aspects involved in this, and then there's sort of there was a EU study on the middle corridor that came out this past summer that used the phrase sort of soft connectivity, and that had more to do with sort of local regulations and the sort of the borders and a whole bunch of sort of institutional issues that need to be resolved in order to operationalize a project of that scale. And I think that stuff is way less sexy to talk about than new rail lines, but, you know, trade has to move. And if you want that route to be useful, it has to move smoothly. And so there's a lot of work to be done, but I think there's a lot more interest than previously in that. One sort of question I have is, what is the impact of this kind of engagement on sort of the domestic atmosphere and sort of domestic politics? Because, you know, as Central Asia becomes more interconnected with itself and more interconnected with the world, I think, you know, people start to sort of realize there are other ways of doing things. And I think it will be interesting to see how these systems adapt.
Hey, great. Thank you. Still got a lot of ground to cover. Luca, the fact that to return to the C5, the fact that they're traveling, you know, I've been joking. This is like the world tour 2023 for the five Central Asian leaders. They're all in all these cities. You know, they're in the first, for lack of a better way of putting it, they're in the first generation of leaders of Central Asia. There were many times where you couldn't have had all five of them in the same room at the same time. They just didn't get along that much. How much does it say that about regional relations that the five are traveling as a band to all these different countries to meet with a leader, specific leader of another country?
Well, I think it's an important signal, isn't it? There is this trend, as Nagis was saying before, that the regional relations are improving. They've been improving since 2016 when there's been a leadership change in Uzbekistan. So it seems to me that now these five elite, you know, with their presidents, do seem to have some kind of convergence in the way in which they see the regional relations within the region, but also how the region is perceived, you know, outwardly. So, yes, I mean, there is some kind of a bend. To me, what was interesting is that we need to see how these different proposals from the outside, you know, from the US, from the EU, from the individual EU member states, from China, are actually received within the region and are digested and transformed into actual projects. I was very interested to hear before that, you know, there is money, you know, like there is some, it's not just interest that is attracted to Central Asia, but it's also, there is apparently, you know, a bit of cash flying around the region for some kind of projects that involve the region and the external part. So this actually could be a truly important moment, a watershed in the real sense of the word. But again, I like this trend to becoming more stronger, to becoming more visible. And also, you know, like, and the thing is that if the Ukrainian war does not stop this trend, it actually makes me think that you could see more. And these five leaders, you know, to answer your question directly now, Bruce, I think they get along fairly well. They don't really have the kind of rivalries and problems that we've seen with the prior generations. And they all been able to understand the region in their individual foreign policy projects in a way that is converging and has got some kind of point in common. So this is a positive development, as it was the connectivity from the law that was produced by Mirziyoyev. So again, you know, let's just see what happens in the next few years. But the planets seem to have aligned in this particular area.
Okay, great. Thank you. And okay, we'll get to our last point. Although if you have any comments that you want to make, that you, issues that you don't think were addressed, please feel free when I call on you to bring those up. But what I want to ask is, you know, the big debate, of course, that we see all over the place on social networks and at conferences is you know, is Russia out? Are they on the wane? You know, what's the future with Russia? Understanding that they're accepting that Russia is there for a long haul. Is it fair to at least say that the Central Asians have grown more independent because of their much more frequent engagement with other foreign partners than they were prior to February 2022? Katie, I'll start with you.
I have thought a lot about this question, and I don't know that I have a great answer. I'm still thinking about it. You know, I am not so convinced that Russia is gone from Central Asia, and I don't think anybody's really saying that. But I do sort of hesitate to take, you know, Central Asia's engagements with other countries just at that face value as sort of a rebuke to Russia. Because if you look at, for example, Vladimir Putin's very limited travels since the ICC warrant earlier this year, most of them have been to Central Asia. I think it's a region that remains very tied into Russia and, as you mentioned, can't really be extricated. I do think there have been more opportunities for Central Asian countries to engage globally. And so they are seizing those opportunities. But I don't think that they're sort of shaking the hand of the West and, you know, giving the finger to Russia. That's not really how I see that playing out. But we shall see what the future holds.
Great. Thank you. Nargis, I'll give you that question. Let me rephrase it slightly. But is Central Asia in a stronger position when it deals with Russia? Because now they have more friends in the world and some powerful friends that they've been very publicly courting ties with.
Yes. Well, first, of course, Russia is not gone from the region. And Central Asians understand that. As Kazakhstani leaders like to say, Russia is a God-given neighbor. And I would add for better or for worse. So there is understanding that Russia is there. Russia is our big neighbor. And there is no way we can kind of decouple from Russia, distance from Russia. But some things definitely changing. Something has changed. There is a certain, I would say, emancipation of Central Asian states underway, not only states, but also societies. We have been discussing decolonization a lot. There are new generations and they think differently, and they didn't grow up with the idea that Moscow is the capital, you know, is the capital of our country. And having partners and friends outside clearly helps in this endeavor. And I think on the Russian side, there is this growing understanding as well that something is happening, that Central Asian states, I wouldn't say distancing, but they are becoming more sovereign, more independent from Russia. And they're kind of trying to process that. And if you read the Russian experts, there is a certain bitterness that you can sense in what they say and what they write. For example, Sergei Karaganov, whom I'm sure our listeners know, one of the top Russian experts on foreign policy, he said in an interview, "Oh yeah, Central Asia. Of course, Central Asia will be on fire, but it's their own fault." They detached themselves from Russia, and there is this sense that Central Asia is going somewhere, right? And Russia needs to kind of deal with it. And another thing I wanted to add on C5, we've been discussing C5+1 format, but I think it's also worth mentioning C5 without one format. Central Asian leaders have been meeting for consultative meetings since 2018. And I think that's very, very important that they've been having these regular consultative meetings and discussing the regional cooperation agenda and trying to move forward in this regard.
No, thank you. Luca, I'm going to give you the pretty much the same question, but also throw in here too, we remember that when Chinese President Xi Jinping visited Astana in September 2022, Kazakh President Tokayev made a very big deal of going and meeting him at the airport, speaking Chinese with him in front of the cameras. And then, of course, Xi said the words that they really wanted to hear in Kazakhstan, that China will protect Kazakhstan's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Is this in that? Can you read the message that Kazakhstan is kind of saying to Russia, we got other friends now? And can we like transfer that onto other places, you know, other countries too, that Kazakhstan and Central Asia have other friends like Turkey and like the Arab countries and even the United States and European Union?
Oh, well, of course I can. You know, it is unequivocal. The reality is that it's not just that Central Asia is changing, as Nagy said. Russia has also changed. Russia's got a foreign policy horizon much more limited now. That they got the war that they need to worry about. They got the isolation they had to worry about it. They got the reduction of their foreign policy options they had to worry about it, which means that the Central Asians are dealing with now, it's a much different Russia than, you know, let's say 10 years or 5 years ago. Which makes me think that the options that are now presented to Central Asia of international engagement are happening out with the Russia orbit. And to me, that's important because is exactly what we were saying before. You got all these international offers made to Central Asia, and Russia is not really able to counterbalance because they are distracted, they are enmeshed in the mess that Ukraine has become. And to me, that's important because we're talking about an entirely different set of partners, even though we're talking about the same relationship. And this has, of course, the counter-argument that is based on the data of Central Asia's economy circumventing the sanctions question mark, and also about the ingress in Central Asia of this relocanti from Russia. Some of them left, some of them stay, but people-to-people ties are important, which are element that makes me think that, you know, there is still a very important relationship there. The fact that maybe is not coincidental, is it, that we have the Central Asian states being approached by all these international partners at a time at which Russia is limited in its foreign policy options. And, you know, it is part of the process that we saw in the last 10 years that, you know, when Russia polarizes the geopolitics of Eurasia, states like the Central Asian will always try to play different games at the same time, actually do have an access to foreign capitals. I mean, China, you know, is a very important partner, but I would look much more at states from the global south rather than the US and the EU. To me, that's something which I researched for a long time. The real key changer may be the erosion of some, I mean, the transfer of some ties which are with Russia in a newly established relationship with the Gulf states and Iran. That's when you see probably the transfer of energy and other kind of trade. But it's still premature. But what is important, you know, and that's probably to me, you know, the main takeaway, and I think, you know, both Katie and Nagis too having taught me so much, is that you now see this trend much becoming much more clear, that the contour of the geopolitical realignment have become certainly less blurry now. And, you know, and should things change in the same direction in the next 2 or 3 years, then we can start really thinking about, you know, what are the elements of the new set of our international relations that have Central Asia at their own center.
Okay, great. Thanks. Does anyone have anything else they want to say, since I got three such experts on the program right now?
Yeah, I wanted to sort of maybe highlight something we didn't talk so much in depth about, but I know you've covered in other podcasts. Nargis mentioned the decolonization debate, and I think it's really interesting what this geopolitical moment has meant to domestic publics in Central Asia. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, looking into the future, we can't tell you where that's going to go. But I think that is an incredibly important thing to not lose sight of. At the same time, you have governments sort of behaving as governments are going to do, which is taking care of number one. But I think that's something that we should definitely keep an eye on for the future.
Good point. Thank you very much.
Can I add one little comment? Well, definitely we are quite firmly by now in China's orbit. So traditionally we were in Russia's orbit. Over the past three decades, China became kind of this big planet, which we are also quite strongly drawn. But there is the West and there is the European Union. And I think Central Asians feel that it is important to keep strong ties to the West as well. And here I'll quote one Kazakh diplomat who was explaining the importance of the Middle Corridor. And he said that it's not just an economic corridor, it's a civilizational choice. And I think Central Asians want to continue to be the in-between region rather than becoming kind of a periphery of one power. So we see these kind of opportunities now, and we see the active efforts by Central Asian governments to maneuver and to maintain this room for maneuver. But societies, let's not forget about societies and what Katie said. We see the popularity of Western education. If you look at the new universities opening in Uzbekistan, opening in Kazakhstan, there are many partnerships with American universities, with European universities. And I think it's incredibly important if we want to understand in which direction the region will be moving.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, we're at the 50-minute mark, so I will wrap it up here. But thank you, Luca, Katie, and Nargiz for being on the program. And a big thank you to Nathan Shoemaker, our Medjlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Medjlis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thank you much, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.